Though he is a stranger to us, he was certainly no stranger to the people of Israel. As a matter of fact, his name, I'm convinced, was known all across the land. I'm referring to Uriah the Hittite, not David the king. Uriah. Isn't it interesting that we can grow up as Christians, become somewhat familiar with the Bible, and go past significant individuals and sort of relegate them to a minor role that sort of forgotten and not that worthy of remembrance. On the contrary, I believe Uriah was a household name, certainly within the ranks of the Israeli army, and I believe among the people of Israel. Let's begin not in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, but chapter 23. Turn there. We're turning to the end of David's life, where he sort of wraps up a number of things, including those who meant so much to him in battle. At verse 8, he does what he's not done before. He names his mightiest warriors. You will notice, these are the names of David's mightiest warriors. I'd venture to say that you could name none of them. I admit, I wouldn't have known or remembered. First is Yashobim the Hagonite. See what I'm saying? The Hakbonite, I should say. Yashobim. He just killed 800 soldiers in one battle with a spear. Other than that, it was just a day at the office. That's Yashobim. He's the number one in the list of these mighty men. The second is named for us, and the third, and the fourth, and all the way down to the end of the chapter. Go with me to the end. We come to this 38th verse. Ira from Jatir. Gareb from Jatir. Uriah the Hittite. There were 37 in all. Did you realize that Uriah the Hittite was among the elite corps in the Israeli army? We would say one of the Medal of Honor winners, one of the fiercest of the warriors, well known for his heroic and courageous work on the battlefield, well respected among his peers. And this 37 in this elite corps, not unlike our SEALs or those special forces, this elite body could have been the original band of brothers. They had each other's back. No doubt a chest full of medals, if they gave such back in those days, and well respected among the nation. Interesting that Uriah the Hittite was an Israeli soldier. Not an Israeli, but a Hittite. So he was once among the God-worshipping idolaters of the Hittites. And his name, no doubt, was not Uriah, which means Yahweh is my light. Or the Lord is my light. He adopted that name when he converted to Judaism, became a part of his now beloved nation, which he protects with his life and, if necessary, his death. This is quite a man. He may have been Hittite in his birth and blood, but he was Israeli in his heart. It must have been an interesting engagement, if they had such in those ancient days, when his eyes fell upon the beautiful daughter of Eliam. We're never told how they met or how long they knew one another before there was talk of a wedding. I'm sure the rabbi of Bathsheba's community felt it was an honor to officiate at the wedding of a hero like Uriah and a beauty like Bathsheba. I've had hundreds of weddings in my experience as a minister, none that I prize more than military weddings. If you've ever been to one where officers meet and that band of brothers have come together and they've worn their swords, and when it's time for leaving the ceremony, they flash those swords and they form a tunnel and you walk beneath the swords on the way out. Still gives me a chill. I love military weddings. And I think Uriah's must have been like that. As he and Bathsheba, she's on his arm. What a couple they were. They needed a place to live. And even though we have no record of their searching for a house, how wonderful it was when the bride and groom were offered a little place in the shadow of the royal palace. Perfect. Uriah admired no one more than the one who occupied that palace. It was his king whom he defended at any cost. Uriah and Bathsheba nestled into that little home to begin their honeymoon together and hope for a wonderful series of springtime days together as they would enjoy the pleasures of marriage and the beginning of life as a couple. It must have been wonderful. The beautiful flowers of Israel are in bloom. The cool breezes from the Mediterranean even reach up as far as the elevation of Jerusalem. Then one day there's a knock at the door and Uriah reads his orders that come from the king. He's ordered into battle, of all things. That treacherous, implacable enemy, the Ammonites, are at it again. They're trying to take Rabbah, the city above them. And the army is needed. And that means those 37, or at least Uriah among the 37, were called into duty, and his orders were cut, and there's no arguing and no disagreement. And Bathsheba must have broken into tears, thinking her groom would leave, and who knows what he would face. The possibility of being killed in battle was a very real thing, as every bride of any soldier or marine or sailor knows. And he mounts up, and after a long embrace and many kisses and quiet farewells, he makes his way with his outfit up to Rabbah. What's interesting is when he gets there, he doesn't see the king. It was common in ancient days for the king to lead the troops in battle. It's not like that at all now. The highest ranking general, or certainly the commander in chief, is never on the front lines, always protected. But in those days, the king led the fight. But in this day, it's Joab. Joab's been appointed the field commander. He will lead the battle at Rabbah. Uriah learns of that, and whoever it may be, he will certainly cooperate with the plan because Joab is appointed by his king. So Uriah would answer to Joab as the battle begins. All of a sudden, we're moved in just a single verse back to Jerusalem, to the bedchamber of David, who is taking a nap while his soldiers are fighting. We're never told why. Why didn't he go into battle? Why did he hang back at the palace? For whatever reason, it was late in the afternoon, after he had enjoyed a midday rest, that he stretches himself, sitting on the side of his bed, stands up. It must have been hot in the room, so he turns and decides to walk out where there might be a cooler breeze on the roof of the palace. When he does, he hears the splashing of water. David's never taken the time to observe who his neighbors are. Suddenly, he's interested in one of them. He sees the body of a beautiful naked woman bathing. You know, preachers have down through the years chosen to make Bathsheba a part of this whole illicit affair, but I find it hard to do that. I think she may have normally bathed here. She didn't see the king, though he saw her, and he inquired who she was. He didn't even know the name of the neighbor. Someone said to him, "She is the daughter of Eliam, the wife of one of the 37, the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Doesn't faze David. He says to the servant, "Get her for me." At this point, lust takes over. I pause not to preach here, but just to remind all of us that lust has a way of, well, as the Proverbs puts it, binding us and grinding at us and blinding us. Blinded by lust, forgetting that he has other women already, his wives in the palace, he wants another one. Forgetting who he is and forgetting the respect the nation has for him. I mean, it's the city of David. It's the star of David on the flag. It's David's royal palace. But right now, it's David who wants a woman. Bring her to me. She comes. The two of them lie together. Adultery is committed, and she quickly is on her way. I think David thought little of it by now. His guilt has blinded him to even a concern about what has happened, until he gets word from her that changes everything. "I am pregnant." Now, since we're reading the story and hearing it, sitting in this place filled with lights and surrounded by fellow believers, it's a good place to just think clearly, which David was not doing. When you are consumed now by guilt, as Alexander White puts it, soaked to his eyes in guilt, your mind plays tricks on you. And he commits the second sin in all of time. The first was the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden when they took of the tree. The second was their hiding. Rather than admitting to God they had eaten of the forbidden fruit, they hid and they covered up. Interesting words appear in the Genesis account in chapter 3. After they had sinned, they knew suddenly that they were naked. They'd been naked all along, but when sin came, they, for the first time, were self-conscious, self-aware. And they covered up, as if they could hide from God or cover their sin. But David doesn't think of any of that. He thinks of one thing. I've got to get Uriah in bed with his wife. Whatever it takes. Uriah is on the battlefront, remember? A messenger hands him a message. You are to return to meet with the king in the royal palace. Remember, Uriah has never read 2 Samuel 11. Okay? It's easy to forget that. We're privy to information that even the characters on the page are not. He must have thought, what an honor to pull me from battle. What a privilege is mine for my king to ask an audience with me. Without hesitation, Uriah takes the message and does exactly as it says. I can only picture it. He comes off his mount as he reaches the steps of the palace. He walks up. That palace guard must have stood at ramrod attention, snapped a salute. He returns it, walks in, and is escorted back to the private chamber of David the king. As he enters, everyone else in the room leaves, the door closes, and here is that unbelievable moment. He, face to face with the king of Israel. His heart must have been in his throat. What an honor. And he waits to hear what the king will say. Look at the words. Listen to the hypocrite. When Uriah arrived, verse 7, David asked him, how's Joab? And how's the battle progressing? He didn't care about either one. He wanted Uriah home with his wife. But Uriah must have thought this is going to lead to something far more important. They're fine. The battle is going well, my king. Great. Verse 8, go on home, Uriah. Rest. Rest? Go home? Surely there's more in David's mind than this. Why, as a matter of fact, for the first time in his entire life, he doesn't obey an order. We read specifically, Uriah didn't go home, verse 9. That night he slept with the palace entrance guards at the king's palace. Where did he go between the time he left and the time he went to sleep in the entrance if he didn't go home? Here's another question for you. I deliberately looked past it. Verse 8, David told Uriah, go on home and relax. David even sent a gift to Uriah after he left. What was the gift? No one even addresses it in any of the commentaries I checked, and I checked over a dozen. None of my resources address either what was the gift or where Uriah went. I'm intrigued by those kind of mysteries. I don't know. So if you're waiting for the answer, I can't tell. It's never answered here or anywhere else. We're just left. I wonder what Bathsheba thought when the gift arrived at the home and Uriah wasn't there. How strange it was that David would send a gift, no doubt to his home. Maybe it sat there, right there at the entrance. And maybe she thought, maybe Uriah's coming back. She doesn't know. I'm convinced Bathsheba was not a part of this plot at all. But whatever, he spends the night in the palace entrance, of all things. This top elite soldier rolls up a garment and makes it his pillow and sleeps on the floor right there in the palace. The next morning, verse 10, when David heard that Uriah had not gone home, he summoned him. Well, I would imagine. And he asked, oh, what's the matter? Oh, why didn't you go home last night after being away for so long? I love Uriah's reply. I love it. Listen to the integrity. He is speaking to the king of Israel. I could not do that. The ark, the armies of Israel and Judah are living in tents. Joab and your men are camping in the open fields. How could I go home to wine and dine and sleep with my wife? I swear I would never do such a thing. That's how soldiers lose their rank. That's how you get mustered out of the corps. But David doesn't do that. I think his mouth must have dropped open. He's never seen such integrity. I could not do that. I will not do that. It's as if David shrugs and says, all right, stick around another day and we'll have dinner together tonight and then you can go back tomorrow. So Uriah stayed, we read, stayed that day at Jerusalem, and the next day David invited him to dinner and got him drunk. How low can David go? If he can't convince him while he's sober, maybe he will yield when he's inebriated. And even then, we read, Uriah doesn't go home. Again, another night in the palace entrance. Uriah's a better man drunk than David is sober. I cannot do that. I will not do that. Those are our men. So look at what happens. Watch. We read in verse 14, the next morning David wrote a letter to Joab and gave it to Uriah. Uriah, give this to Joab. His death warrant. He knew that Uriah would never, ever open that letter. That letter was safe in Uriah's pouch. It's exactly where it went. An amazing man. I rather suspect Uriah is thinking, even now, this is the strategy. David needed time to think it through. It's the message for my field commander and for me. We're going to work in some way together. And what a privilege it'll be to carry this out as I take this message from my king to my commander. He arrives and I want to pause for a moment and set the record straight before you get overly impressed with Joab. Go back to chapter 3 the end of the chapter. You need to see this. Joab is a distant relative of David, by the way. He is more than that. Joab has just killed Abner, a strong warrior, and it incenses David. The end of the chapter, you pick up the story at verse 38. Look at this. You can't miss it. Then King David said to his officials, "Don't you realize that a great commander has fallen," referring to Abner, "has fallen today in Israel? And even though I am the anointed king, these two sons of Zeruiah, Joab and Abishai, are too strong for me to control." Look at that statement. Look at that statement. Joab was one of those conniving officers who, I'm convinced, remained suspicious of David. Nevertheless, a good warrior, certainly brutal, able to fight. But you'll notice something here back into chapter 11. When Uriah returns to the battle, look at this. He gave the letter to deliver, and the letter instructed Joab, I'm at verse 15, "Station Uriah on the front lines where the battle is fiercest, then pull back." In other words, take away all the defense. He's a sitting duck, so that he will be killed. I've marked only one line in this chapter in my Bible. That's the line. It is a premeditated murder. Have him killed. Stop. Joab reads the instructions in the letter. Joab knows that Uriah is one of the 37. He's telling me to have him killed. Joab's already the suspicious type. I won't carry that theory much further, but I'll leave it with you. I am convinced in my heart he understood the command. He'll do it. He folds it up, puts it in his pouch, and sees it as checkmate blackmail when he needs it. He's got David just where he wants him. Whatever is going on, this is wrong. You don't kill one of your top 37. You don't kill any of your own men deliberately. This is instruction to take him out. So Joab does exactly that. He assigned him to the point most threatened, where the enemy's strongest men were fighting. And when the enemy soldiers came out of the city to fight, Uriah the Hittite was killed. Notice, along with several other Israeli soldiers. So he's not only killed Uriah, he's killed other soldiers. I'm sure Joab covered that so that it wouldn't look like what it was. It would look like just a skirmish, and they got the raw end of the deal and they lost Uriah. Now, David must be wondering by now what's happened on the battlefield. So Joab solves the question. Verse 18, he sent a battle report to David. He told his messenger, look closely, Report all the news of the battle to the king. He might get angry and ask, why did the troops go so close to the city, meaning the city of Rabbah? Didn't they know that there would be shooting from the walls? Wasn't Abimelech, son of Gideon, killed at Thebes by a woman who threw a millstone down on him? Oh, why would you get so close to the wall? Then tell him Uriah the Hittite was killed too. Oh, be sure and add that. Watch. Back in Jerusalem, the messenger went to Jerusalem and gave the complete report to David. The enemy came out against us, the open fields, and said, you know, he said, and as we chased them back to the city gate, the archers on the wall shot arrows at us. Some of the king's men were killed, including Uriah the Hittite. Why did he want him killed? Well, for sure, the pregnancy would become known, and he would have to face Uriah, because Bathsheba would quite likely yield the name. He thought this would remove part of the accusation or the possibility of such. Well, says David, listen to the hypocrite. Well, then, tell Joab not to be discouraged. The sword devours one today and this one today and that one tomorrow. It's okay. Fight on harder. Hail to Israel. Shame on you, David. What a pathetic example of a leader. When the period of mourning was over after Bathsheba learned of her husband's death, David brought her into the palace. Watch closely, and verse 26, she became one of his wives. He already has several. Now he's got another one. If you want to know how David felt deep within for the next number of months, read Psalm 32 and a portion of Psalm 51. He's miserable beyond words. They have the baby, and 7 days the baby dies. Not only this, the sword never departed from David's house. His life looks like a rooftop. From the fields of Jesse's sheep all the way to Bathsheba. From Bathsheba all the way to the end, it comes down on him. Why? The last statement, the Lord was displeased with what David had done. The Hebrew reads, it was evil in the eyes of the Lord. I prefer that. His eyes, he saw it all. He heard it all. Secret sins on earth, open scandal in heaven. Why would the Lord preserve 27 verses of a chapter out of his word for this story? David at his worst, Uriah at his most vulnerable, Joab at his most treacherous. The whole thing is just this. It is a study in carnality. Now, You know me too well. We won't just close the Bible and have prayer. There are lessons here. Lessons we learn from Uriah, from David, from Joab, and the Lord himself. First, how magnificently a man of integrity and loyalty like Uriah can live his life. How magnificently a man of integrity like Uriah can live his life. I think I speak today to some with that kind of integrity, and I salute every one of you. If I knew you, I would honor you and call you by name. You are needed more than you ever would realize in this day and age in which we live. You will not take a bribe. You will not do wrong, even if it means your job. You will not cooperate, even though you respect the one who is urging you to cooperate, something that will require compromise. You won't do it. We honor you today. You're in the camp of Uriah, who died with honor, though deceived terribly by the man he trusted the most in the nation. How magnificently a man of integrity like Uriah can live his life. You can do it, even though you're surrounded by most who don't. You can do it. Stay at it. And if you begin now, good for you. Stay at it from here on. Second, how hypocritically a man like David, a man of importance and authority, can hide his sins. Part of the problem is his authority and importance. When you reach a certain level in life, and the world, it seems, is looking up to you, it is so easy at that point to lose your self-awareness, to lose the reality of your compromise. And hypocrisy takes over and replaces what was once integrity and responsibility. I mean, we can't imagine David, the giant killer, David, the one who preserved Saul's life, David, the one who backs away when Abigail says, "You don't want murder on your record." Thanks, Abigail, for the warning, and doesn't follow through in the murder of Nabal. "Let's not have murder on my record." This is the same man. You see, your mind plays tricks on you when you become the king. He's now there. He is the resident in the palace. He calls the shots. Hypocrisy can take the place of integrity so easily. I don't know where you are in your life. I don't know what promotions you've recently had. I'm sure they were well deserved, but I warn you, be careful about that climb up. I heard the comment the mother ape said to her little ape. "Don't climb too high on the pole. The higher you climb, the more they'll see your rump." Be careful up there. Be careful. Careful. They respect you. They believe you. Uriah didn't even question his command. I just can't go home. They never had a fleeting thought of why he would ask him to do that. David was so trusted by this warrior. Now, here's the third. The first was how magnificently a man of integrity and loyalty can live his life. The second, how hypocritically a man of importance and authority can hide his sins. Third, how treacherously a man under the authority of another, like Joab, can assist in the wrongdoing of his leader. Joab is a treacherous man. He knew that was wrong. He knew it was wrong to kill one of their heroes. If there's ever a time to question the command, now's the time. I can't have it on my conscience to see that Uriah's killed. David, we've got to talk this over. Not Joab. Nope. I'll use this someday. It'll really come in handy. If you are serving as an assistant, as a second in command, or further, be careful about blindly following the leader. Who knows but what you were given that role to caution the leader, or to counsel the leader, or warn the leader. Now, the fourth applies to all of us. How completely our God, who knows and sees and hears everything about us, holds each one of us accountable. We are a grace-believing people. I would love to think that those who know of the ministry of Stonebriar Community Church will soon, in describing us, include the word grace. We believe it with our whole heart. We preach it. We embrace it. But never to the point of ignoring the holiness of our God and forgetting we are accountable to Him who sees us, knows us, hears us, holds us accountable. Listen to the key verse, Hebrews 4, verse 12. Just listen. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God. Everything is naked and exposed before His eyes, and He is the one to whom we are accountable. If you miss the verse, that's your next memory verse. Hebrews 4:12. He sees and knows and hears it all, and to Him we are accountable, every one of us. From the highest to the lowest, if you want to rank people that way. From the known to the unknown. From the respected to the gutter drunk. We're all accountable. And that will hold us close to our Heavenly Father and remind us obedience is always appropriate. Disobedience, never. Doing right, always best. Doing wrong, never. Oh, David. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempts he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. When lust conceives, it brings forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, gives birth to death. One of my mentors, Ray Stedman, used to describe that as a death-like existence. From this point until he confesses to Nathan, David lives a death-like existence. He is phony to the core, and he knows it. Finally, by the grace of God, he was willing to admit, I am the man. And he bowed in humble confession. Let's all bow together. Will you do that, please? Soul-searching message, I realize, for all of us. Do you know the Lord as your master, as your God and Savior? Are you living for Him? Or are you faking it? Have you begun to develop a hypocritical lifestyle, covering up for something that should have been dealt with some time ago? Stop. Today's the day to deal with it. You don't answer to me, you answer to the one who sees and knows and hears it all. He's the one to whom we are all accountable. As a child of His, come to Him and you will find His arms open and His willingness to forgive. Oh, no, there may be consequences, but you'll be forgiven. There may be a price to pay for the cover-up, as there was with David's life, but you'll be forgiven, and you'll know again the joy of sins forgiven and a fresh new beginning. If you've never met the Lord, you have no hope of changing. Your life will rock along pretty much like it has all this time, and you'll just tell yourself you're going to do better. With every new year, you'll make another resolution, and you'll break it before the month is out. What you need is a Savior, Christ. And when you get Him, you then get the power you need to withstand, to choose to do right and to carry it out. Trust Him now. Please turn to Him. Let us help you if you need help with that as you come to the Lord as a sinner. Just come like you are. Take Him. Accept Him as your own. Father, thank you for your help in giving strength to deliver this twice this morning. Thank you for searching me and forcing me to go through all this time of study and delivery. So search me, O God, and know my heart. See if there be any way of pain in me. And lead me to deal with it if it's there. And the same for those who hear me. Be pleased with our lives, Father, in a day in which so few are trustworthy. Use today as the beginning point for all of us to walk with you in integrity. In the name of Christ, I pray. Everyone said.